Hi, this is Diane Lees, the Outspoken Cyclist. The following is a presentation that I gave to the Westerville Bicycle Club annual banquet this past February 2014, and I've decided to offer it to you as an independent podcast. Hopefully, you will enjoy it. Here we go. Hello, Westerville Bicycle Club. Thank you for inviting me to your annual banquet. As Kathy told you, my name is Diane Lees, and I am the Outspoken Cyclist. I am a 40-year veteran of the bicycle business, and I'd like to speak with you this evening about how I transitioned from bike shop know-nothing in 1974 to bike shop owner in 1984, and finally to becoming the host and producer of the Outspoken Cyclist radio show. The saying, the more things change, the more things stay the same, is a good way of looking at the bicycle business. Essentially, we are still riding a two-wheeled, human-powered machine that is usually chain-driven with pneumatic tires. The bike shop in 1974 was typically a mom-and-pop store, most often run by the owner with after-school helpers. In my case, the shop occupied a space next to a hardware store at the corner of a main street and a side street in a residential neighborhood. But if someone from the 60s, who hadn't been on a bike in a long time, walked into a modern-day bike shop, I think she might be very puzzled by much of what she was seeing, from the bicycle itself to those who were selling them. Today we see multi-store chains, big-box-type stores like Performance Bike, and a plethora of online sales outlets. Even the few remaining mom-and-pop shops have some sort of online presence. And I believe one of the most encouraging changes in the bicycle business has been a consistent increase in the number of women in the industry, from shop floor to manufacturing floor. But let me begin at the beginning. I got my first two-wheeler at about the age of 6. It came with the warning to not leave the driveway. Of course, my dad turned his back. I rolled down the driveway, onto the sidewalk, and promptly fell off and skinned both of my knees. Interestingly enough, though, that's about all I remember of that first bike or of my dad's reaction. I remember a time when my father, the most mechanically declined person I've ever known, took me to the Silverton Bike Shop in Cincinnati to have a flat tire changed on the back of my bike. I still have this lingering sense of that store, kind of dark, with dusty floors, and bikes, and tires, and tubes, and stuff everywhere, and a very nice man who helped my dad. It was how I must have perceived the bike shop in those days. Although I don't remember the circumstances around when or how I got it, I do remember owning and riding my English racer, a green Phillips 3-speed that was eventually stolen off of our back porch. Or perhaps it just rolled away on its own, sad at being abandoned, because I had turned 16 and my way to freedom went from two wheels to four. I went away to college, got married, became a mother, and then something happened in my late 20s that would change my relationship with the bicycle forever. It was 1973, and there before me was my first 10-speed. I was mesmerized. It was a white, mixedy LaPierre with turquoise blue decals, and the shifting was horrible. The chain kept slipping off the chain rings. I guess it could have been the person doing the shifting, but I did come to understand that it had something to do with the Simplex derailleurs. At the time, though, I really didn't know that. In fact, I didn't know a Presta from a Schrader or a top tube from a down tube. But something about that bicycle struck a chord in me, and I needed to know more. Just to put it into context, we were in the middle of a bicycle boom, and the 10-speed was all the rage. Soon, however, we would also be in the middle of a gas shortage. Since I knew the bike shop owner and I needed a job, it seemed pretty reasonable to me that I should go to work in this special store where wheels were being built and adults were coming in to buy these sleek, sexy 10-speed bicycles. I was a sponge. learning everything I could about what went on and what I perceived was this magical place, eventually making myself indispensable. I learned about cotter pins and cranks and how to tape handlebars. I changed tires and even tried to true wheels, something I have never mastered, even to this day. And I loved working with the customers. We sold some interesting brands in those days, Batavus from Holland, Saito and Kabuki from Japan. And then one day, a Behr frame set came in and I was to be once again forever changed. It was deep burgundy in color, it had beautiful short point lugs, and it had the name Serrata on the down tube. It was a 23-inch touring frame, because in those days we didn't measure in centimeters, and when it was built up, it weighed nothing. Of course, by today's standards, it was a boat anchor weighing in at just over 23 pounds, but it didn't matter to me. I thought it was a magnificent machine. If I had been hooked on the bicycle before, my interests were accelerated by light years with this sudden notion of a high-end pro market. In 1979, we moved the shop to a larger space on a busier street, and eventually I bought out the original owner. The bike business had its ups and downs in the intervening years, which it turns out hasn't changed much. At one point when the mountain bike was introduced, the market became flooded with these fat tire machines, and several companies, including Trek, found themselves inundated with inventory. They, in turn, slashed their prices, and many dealers were caught with too many bikes and a lot of debt. By the time 1984 came around and I had been through 10 bike seasons, I began to explore what would become a big part of what made my work so rewarding, and it turns out somewhat prophetic, bike fitting. It was a bit ahead of its time, and I would get a big jump on it. We found this funky-looking Italian fitting machine that would only permit me to lengthen or shorten the stem, raise or lower the saddle, and move the saddle fore and aft. It had no real crank or resistance. The pedals just spun around freely. It soon became clear that taking even small measurements from the fitting machine and transferring them to the bike made a big difference for the rider, any rider, not just the racer or the pro. As time went on, I began to sort out the relationships, the connections that made it possible for riders to become comfortable, efficient, and powerful. How someone sat on the saddle and what happened to his hands, feet, knees, hips, neck, and back became the focus of my work. I was, and still am, convinced that no one is average. All the while, the bike industry was making enormous technological breakthroughs. We quickly went from 10 speeds to 12 and then 14. In rapid succession, we saw index shifting, clipless pedals, and small electronic devices to measure your distance and your speed. Aerodynamics began creeping into components, and frame materials not only included steel and aluminum, but were soon joined by carbon fiber and titanium. By this time, I was part of a new shop in downtown Cleveland. The building was located in the warehouse district and hadn't been occupied for decades. The space had the original tin ceilings and diagonally laid wood floors, common to that era. There was a dramatic staircase leading to an office upstairs, and when the rehab was completed, it was stunning, almost too pretty for a bike shop. We had a full service department with several technicians, but much of our work became focused around our small on-floor workstation. And because of my near obsession with making people comfortable on their bikes, every bike we were selling was in need of refitting, whether it be a different saddle, swapping out narrower or wider handlebars, or choosing a longer or shorter stem. We began to work with crank arm length and took a lot of time and effort to make certain that cleat adjustments were just so. We were spending hours working with people to cram non-average bodies onto average-sized bikes. And soon we found ourselves with boxes of slightly used and mostly useless saddles and stems. Then a new idea began to percolate in my mind. Why not just offer real custom bikes? Frames that were fit, designed, and built around the rider with the appropriate bar and stem and a saddle chosen by the customer. My old friend Ben Serrata had developed a size simulator, and we brought one into the shop. In addition to Cerrada, we began working with builders like Merlin, Waterford, and Calfee, and soon were selling a fair number of custom bikes, although in those days, we did not do frame design. In early spring of 1996, negotiations began to sell the downtown location. By summer, I was deep into writing a book about bicycle touring, and a few months later, I decided that it was time for me to pursue my dream store. On February 11th, 1997, my book rolled off the presses, and I opened a little shop in Cleveland Heights that sold custom bikes only. A shop that not one of my suppliers believed would be a viable retail concept. But the laugh was to be on them. My partner Brian, a mechanical engineer and master wheel builder, relocated from upstate New York, and as a team, we continued to perfect our fitting techniques, only with the added bonus of being able to design the frames. While other stores continued to struggle with managing inventories, we focused on building bikes one at a time. And for the next 16 years, Brian and I became known as Hubbub Custom Bicycles and were one of only a handful of shops around the country that did this kind of one-on-one work. In 2002, I also became a certified yoga instructor, adding more insight into our fitting techniques. We decided we needed more space and in the middle of 2004, moved our shop out of the city and into the exurbs. Like the child whose eyes are bigger than her stomach, it seemed perfectly logical to me to build a new bike shop that included a yoga studio and, let's throw in, a coffee shop, a business about which we knew nothing. We had learned of other bike shops around the country diversifying their businesses to help augment off-season sales. Now the laugh would be on us. Looking back, it was one of those ideas that sounded so good and turned out so badly. Circumstances almost pushed us into bankruptcy, but we persevered and somehow in 2005 began to crawl out of the other end. We settled into a pretty good routine and then, oh yes, the recession hit. Luckily, though, the lessons we learned from our move to this location served us well and we knew how to hunker down and wait it out. Other shops weren't as lucky, and the internet was beginning to encroach on the bike business in a sure and permanent way. In the fall of 2009, just as things were getting back to a semblance of normal, I received a phone call from someone I had never met, and it changed my life one more time. Go figure. He said his name was Larry and that he worked for Clear Channel, that shock jock, run the damn cyclist off the road radio conglomerate, and that there was an opportunity to make Clear Channel toe the line about cyclists. His station manager had given him the green light to produce a one-hour weekly radio show for a 21-week trial. Would I like to be the host of this show? Well, I was flattered, which I'm sure was the point. I also didn't know anything about hosting, let alone producing a radio show. Absolutely nothing. And this show was to be live, which meant there were no do-overs and no bad language. Always up for a challenge, I was about to get an education that might be likened to baptism by fire. I was given a great co-host who was a sports radio veteran and a sound engineer who really wanted to be involved in the project. And everyone told me they would hold my hand until I got the hang of it. And so on Monday, April 5th, 2010, I sat behind a microphone with a set of gigantic headphones perched on my head next to someone I'd never met. Denny, the sound engineer, called the phone number I'd provided, gave me a signal, and suddenly I was on the air interviewing Richard Schwinn. Oh my goodness, I was hooked. I don't have a clue how the rest of that first show went. I do know that it went fast. On my way home from the station that evening, giddy with the excitement of this new adventure, my cell phone rang and I saw it was Richard Schwinn on the caller ID. I thought to myself, uh-oh. Richard and I have been friends a long, long time. I was one of his very first Waterford dealers back in the early 90s, and he had been very reluctant to be my first guest on the radio. I didn't need to be worried, though. He wanted to know when he could come back on and do it again. And so just like that day, way back in 1974, when I saw the Cerrada touring frame set in the shop, being in that radio station fulfilled something in me about my work that I'd never experienced before. I had been involved in a lot of different things in my career in the bike business. I hadn't just been a bike dealer. I'd also been a writer for our trade journal and a seminar leader at some of the trade shows. I'd been a ride and race director. I knew a lot of people, and I'd also been an outspoken critic of many of the bicycle industry's practices and ideas. But this new role was like taking that 35 years, putting all the pieces into a big paper bag, shaking it up, and letting me put the puzzle back together the way I wanted to. The station, it turns out, was ecstatic. They said I was a natural, and I began to take the work very seriously. I prepared for each show in detail, although it probably sounded pretty amateurish and ad-libbed in those first few broadcasts. My co-host Jim really didn't know anything about bicycles. It was awesome. He was able to be funny and smart while still leading and teaching me how radio worked in a totally supportive and non-confrontational way. He even learned a little bit about bicycles over that summer. In addition to taking all the connections I'd had to people I'd known and worked with over all those years, the door suddenly opened to people I'd never dreamed I would be able to speak with, all because I was a journalist, not just a bike shop owner. It was pretty amazing to me. The 21 weeks went by fast, and the station wanted to know if I would like to come back. Unfortunately, there were some obstacles for me: the long drive, the costs, and a growing difference of artistic opinion on the direction the show should go. And so, even though it almost broke my heart, I told them I would not be returning. But of course, things have a way of working out, don't they? Just as I was winding down the last couple of episodes in Youngstown, one of our clients at the bike shop asked if I'd be interested in moving the show to our local college station, WJCU. Greg, who has been a longtime sound engineer at John Carroll, told me that the lineup for fall was changing and asked if I would come in and meet with the station manager. When I showed up at the station, I realized I already knew the manager. I'd met him years ago at my bike shop downtown. He gave me the go-ahead to produce and host the show right then and there. We picked a time and a day, and that was it. We then needed to come up with a name for the show. Clear Channel said they owned the name of their show and all the podcasts were theirs too, although I was free to download them and tell people about them. It was Greg who came up with the name The Outspoken Cyclist. I hosted the last show in Youngstown on August 30th, 2010. And on September 4th, the first episode of The Outspoken Cyclist on WJCU was broadcast. My first guest on this show was Ben Cerrada. It's funny how things work out, isn't it? Since that interview with Ben, I have had the honor and privilege of speaking with many other frame builders as well as bike company executives. I've interviewed senators, congressmen, and presidential cabinet members. I've spoken with Olympians, transportation specialists, and soldiers who have returned from overseas with injuries too difficult to even think about, but with hearts so big it's amazing they don't burst out of their chests. I get to review lots and lots of new books, talk about medical breakthroughs in areas such as Parkinson's and cancer, and discuss issues facing cyclists, from how to ride in traffic and how bike share programs work, to racing in Africa and heroic trips in the Antarctic. Each week, I walk into the studio at John Carroll, sit down behind the soundboard, and plug my headphones into the system. It is such a privilege and an honor to bring the amazing stories of so many brilliant, talented, and interesting people to the airwaves. I don't know if there is a next phase of my long career in bicycling, a career I never dreamed of as a child, or one I even would have thought about as an adult, but I am endlessly grateful to be able to do this work. By January 2013, I had bid the retail bicycle business goodbye. It has changed so drastically from those first days in 1974 that it is almost unrecognizable. Except we are still riding a two-wheeled human-powered machine that is usually chain-driven with pneumatic tires. Thank you.